Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Here we can see that the free drivers are clearly superior to the closed one because the Apple one, which I was using, didn't work because it apparently wants to use HDCP so that you cannot take copies of my slides. Thank you, Mr. Apple person, whoever chose to do that. Anyway, my name is Jussi, and I'm here to talk about Mezen and with it the changing Linux build landscape. Just to get a view of the audience, I'm going to ask you who have been using it before, and if you can raise your hand. So who are you are already using Mezen for some project? Okay, it's about 1 4. How many of you are not using it but would like to? It's about fourth, maybe fifth. How many are not using it and don't plan to in the future, near future? Three people. And how many of you don't really have a good grasp of what Mezen is? It's about 50%. Okay. So Mezen is a build system, and it's built on a few core principles, which are listed here. And the main thing is that it's a build system that should support for all languages. C and C++ are what we focus on because they're used the most. But we want to support everything. Like, we have support for Java and C# and Rust and D and a bunch of other ones. And we want to be multi-platform, and that means supporting Windows and OS X, Android, iOS, all of those things. Some of these things are quite tricky. Like Windows is its very own special kind of worms, and it has very different limitations to what you would have on a Unix-based machine. And this is one of the reasons why build systems usually don't work only on Windows or not at all on Windows. And the scalability that we have is that it must scale to tens of thousands of files. So this is roughly the size of what Chromium is, which is the biggest development project that we knew of at the time, which people are constantly building on their own machines. It should scale to like the sizes of what you have at Facebook or Google or something, where you have hundreds of thousands of files, but we haven't really actually tested it. But there's nothing in it that should be preventing things from working. Another thing is that it should work for all layers in the stack. So you should be able to compile applications all the way down to something like libc if that's what you want. And to do this, it has to have minimal dependencies. So in this particular case, we depend on Python 3 and only Python 3 and only stuff that's in the standard library. If there's anything that's not in the standard library, we are not allowed to use it. We have to implement it from scratch. And the point of the build system in this particular case is to do all the tedious and boring stuff so that you don't have to. At the very core is the language that you use to define your build. Because this is what you as a developer spend most of your time with. And this is a DSL that we designed for this use case specifically. And it's not Turing complete. And this is by design. And it will never be Turing complete. If someone files a merge proposal adding Turing completeness like functions or something, it will get rejected. And there's a very simple reason for this, is that if you have programmers and you give them the chance, they will start programming. I spoke to a person who works for a very large commercial company, and they're using Scones to do their very, very, very large and complicated build. And then I asked him, so in this thing that you do, does your build system spawn threads? And he was silent for a while and said, yes. And this is not a thing that you as a developer should really be doing. If you need to spawn threads so that the build system can work its thing and build your code, then the build system has failed. This is not. There's many places in the stack where you should really be clever and use all of your skills and all the tools and things. The build system is not one of them. It's just like, make stuff happen and don't worry about it anymore. There are also some other things which are declarative. And we looked into this, but then we specifically chose not to. And the reason for this is that if you have something that's fully declarative, then debugging it is really difficult because you have magic bundles of state, and then something doesn't work. And it's really hard to debug. But if you have something like which is imperative, then it's a lot easier to work with. Here's a simple example, kind of like a Hello World, where we build an application. Sadly, the transitions went away because we had to export this to PDF. But if you go from the top, there's the project, which is given a name, and it's using C. And we say that by default, it's C99. And then there's the next line, which is dependency glib 2.0. So what this does is that it looks up in the system. So is there glib 2 available? It's using package config for this, and then returns it. And if glib 2 is not available, then this will just error out. And then we build an executable, which consists of one file, and then you assign the dependency. And then you have one test, which is just to run this executable, and that's pretty much it. And if it returns 0, then it's a pass. And this there's four declarations, and this is hopefully fairly readable. And even if you've never seen this before, it should be fairly clear what each one of these does. And because readability is the thing that we focused on the most, because that's what you're going to be doing most of the time, is you're going to read what this thing is actually doing. And further, so taking some cues from the functional programming people. Oop. Is it okay? Okay. So there's objects in the system, but they're immutable. So you can create them with some settings, and then they don't change after that. And this allows you to actually reason about things without having to know the entire thing. And the spooky action at distance, if you've done stuff like using make, and there's late bindings, and you have strings, and then they get evaluated later, but someone might have overridden the thing, and then it's broken, and you don't really know why. And we wanted to make those things not possible. And if there's something that's strange, just error out and let the user handle it, rather than try to do the clever and usually the wrong thing. And the goal really is to be out of the user's way as much as possible. The best possible build system would be one where you don't actually even know that it exists. You just write files and then executables magically appear. But we're not there yet, unfortunately. So here's one of the main reasons why people are starting using it. So this is the build logs for systemd as done by Debian. And in version 2.3.4, they changed from using the old one to Mezen. And this is the MIPS build log. And the build time went from 1 hour and 49 minutes to 49 minutes. So more than 50% of the time was wasted in the inefficiencies of a build system, and which we could now get rid of. So systemd is already a user. Then GStreamer is perhaps the biggest user at the moment, so all their plugins, all their core infrastructure. And they were one of the first people to start seriously using it. Their specific use case was that they wanted to support Windows so that they can sell different kinds of service, because people wanted to run GStreamer on Windows with Visual Studio, and using the existing AutoTools build was making it really difficult. And many other GNOME projects are starting to use it. There's Builder, there's GTK, there's glib, and a bunch of other ones. X.org is using it. I'm not sure if it's the default yet, but I think that's what they're planning to do. There is support for Wayland, and I'm not sure if it's landed yet. And then there's Conversion ongoing to convert Mesa, which is the 3D graphics library. They currently have three build systems, and they're trying to get rid of at least two of them. And there are some closed projects. Every now and then, our IRC channel, people come in and it's like, hey, we're doing this sort of secret closed source project, and we have these sorts of problems, and so on. And then apparently it's being used. Unfortunately, I don't know of any specific examples of those. So when you do the transition, and these are the comments people usually get, tell us later, is that you get a big reduction in lines of build definitions, 50% or possibly even more. And increased developer happiness, it's a very big thing. People actually like their tool. And you can tell immediately when you talk to people, it's like that this is actually a thing that improves the quality of their life, which is it's a weird thing to be able to do with just a piece of software. And then things that you can do is that if when your build times go down, you can start doing a lot more stuff. As an example, you can run your CI tests on platforms that aren't as fast, or you can run different configurations that you previously couldn't do. And then there's the Windows support and other closed platforms which become possible to support. And we also provide out-of-the-box support for things like address sanitizer and memory sanitizer and all sorts of those sorts of things where you don't have to think about how the compiler flags actually need to be. You can just toggle an option saying, I want address sanitizer, and then just we take care of all that for you. This is a quote from Richard Hughes, so that's a bit cut off from there, who's an all-around cool guy. I had to do a bug fix release on an old version of a project he was maintaining that was still using the old build system. How could I have tolerated things being that terrible? And this is a very, very common thing which people say, and it's kind of nice to hear. Some stuff about this oncoming. We don't really have that many like major things that we're working on. It's just a steady stream of improving things as they come along. But one of the things which we have been working on, which we've been asked several times, is support for FPGA. So currently we have this experimental branch, with which you can take your firmware code and you compile it with the cross-compiler, and then you get a blob, and then you compile that blob into Verilog, and then you compile that blob into an actual hardware description, and then you can flash that into an FPGA. And it works. It's not like the world's smoothest experience, but it's kind of nice. The main thing that makes this very difficult is that the tool chains for Verilog and VHDL do things like in a crazily different way. Like if you compile C, it's pretty much the same. Like Visual Studio has completely different flags, but the basic idea is the same. But for these sorts of things, like it's just complete madness how like every single tool chain does everything differently. So it's kind of hard to think of a like one simple way of describing all of these. So if there are people here who have FPGA experience and want to help with that, please get in touch with us. It'll be kind of nice to get this going so you could create your free hardware with a fully free tool chain. Another thing that we're working on is dependency management. And since I have you here now, I'm going to do a bit of a feasibility study on a potential feature that we might add. So the problem that we find is that if you look at the build definitions that people write, then you have something like this, is that you have a dependency, and then depending on whether it's found or not, there's a bug, it should say optional there. But if it's found, then you create an executable or a library or something, and then you have to test again if it was found to build the actual test. And on its own, this is not really such a bad thing, but if you have many of these toggle options, then it gets a bit tedious. So we thought of ways of making it simpler. There's been lots of discussion on how to get this working. And so the thing we're kind of thinking about is having something like this, is that in Mezzan you can have options, which are just like random options that you can have. And you could specify as a dependency that an option is this kind of that name. And from the outside, you can specify that the value of that option is either required, it's optional, or disabled. And the interesting thing is that if you choose disabled, then what happens is that this system, that this function call will return an object that's called the disabler. And what it does is that you can ask for it is found and it will return false. And that's the only operation that you can do. But the thing is that if you then pass this into any function, it will not evaluate that function at all. It will just return the same disabler object. And the thing is that if you have a dependency that has this is disabler, you put it inside a function call to create an object, you get another object which is also disabler. So all the way through the chain, not all of the things that would depend on this just go away. And if you're familiar with not the number concept in floating point math, this is pretty much the same. So then your build definition file would look something like this. You have an option that's called patented, and then you could say whether you have the patent license to use this specific one. And if you say patented things are disabled, then all of this becomes a no-op. The only thing that remains is the project call at the top. And this would be kind of a simplification of things. So how many of you would find this sort of option? Oh, we see. So raise your hand if you would find this useful. Okay, there's a good show of hands. That's good to know. Oh, so we might be adding something like this in the future. So if you have any ideas of how to make this nicer, please let us know. It would be nice to get this so we can get things simpler. So now everything is fine, and we have our new build system, and things are fine, fast, and simple, and everything is fine. Well, since we are in Germany, let's do a thought experiment. One of the things which is changing currently in the Linux ecosystem is that there's a lot of new programming languages which have been coming up. So let's create one of our own as a thought experiment. It's called Dost, which is completely random, and which has all sorts of cool features. Is notably, it compiles a lot slower than C. Doesn't have a stable ABI. It doesn't support package config, nor shared libraries. And everything that you do is that you always compile everything from source, all of your dependencies all at once, and then you create one statically linked object. And inside this thing, it has its own dependency downloader, resolver, and all of that stuff. And all of your dependencies are inside your tarball that you ship, and they're compiled possibly with your own compiler flags, which are not the same as for everyone else using it. Okay, so what if this thing exists? So the static linking is a thing that I saw some some very disappointed faces in the audience when I mentioned static linking, but static linking does have its uses. So if you're doing bare metal development, then static linking is mandatory because that's just how things work. If you are working on something like would be called an app, so like an iPhone app or a Flatpak app, which is its own unique bundle thing, then static linking is kind of useful because then everything goes into one and it's kind of nice. There are lots of talks about containers in this conference. So if you have a container with one statically linked executable to do just one thing, then it's really kind of nice because then if someone compromises that, there's no shell, they can't escape and they can't do all these nasty things. And there's a bunch of other reasons why you would want to do that. However, so what happens to distros? So I'm going to ask my assistant here to wave her magical paw. There you go. And now, we have completely rewritten glib and all of the packages that depend on it in the DOS programming language. And then, we do a glib update. Now what happens? Existing glib compiles on a regular machine in about a minute. So this is not an exact number, but it's like a rough estimate of how long it takes to compile. So what sort of slowdowns do we get? So first of all, you get 2x slowdown because in these languages that we have, the new and upcoming ones, you have to compile your source code twice. You compile it once to get the executables or the libraries and so on, and then you have to compile them a second time with different flags so that the unit tests that are embedded inside of it get generated. So that's 2x slowdown. Then about 10 times slower is the compilation speed, and there are 2,906 direct dependencies dependence of glib in Debian using the numbers that I used. So what does this mean? This is a slowdown factor of about 60,000, which it comes to about 40 days of CPU computers running. This is not just CPU time, it's actual wall time. So it's a bit of a jump from 1 minute to 40 days. But like, okay, if you have lots of hardware and all that sort of things, it's doable. But what about if you have MIPS in your thing? So MIPS is usually one or two cores, and laptop machines have four or eight, so it's about four times longer. And then the CPUs are about 10 times slower. So this is where the broken transitions. Oh, Okay, so the white text at the bottom actually says that glib update takes 4 years and 140 days. And as you can probably guess from the text, this is not actually true. The 4 years and 140 days is not the time it takes to do a glib update, it's the amount of time that it just takes to recompile glib for every single one of your dependencies that use it, because you can't use the system one because it might be special. And even this is incorrect, because you don't compile just the library that use glib, you have to do the transitive closure of all the dependencies, because if there is no stable API, then you can't rely on it and you have to rebuild all of the things that depend on it. And again, the lack of traces is going to be unfortunate here, but I did the math, I downloaded the package information, there was about 28,000 something packages in Debian unstable at the time of counting. Anyone in the audience want to guess how big is the transitive closure, dependency closure of glib? I hear 12,000, anyone else? So 28,000-ish is about the amount of source packages. 26,849 is the number of source packages that are in, and once the thing detects, okay. Okay, so I'll just continue because there's shorter time. So there are 26,800 source packages and the transitive closure of glib is 26,500. So there are about 300 packages that don't depend on glib either directly or indirectly. And like the only major piece of infrastructure that is in there is Go. Okay. So, but this problem is not really limited to just the new programming languages. So, this year at CppCon, there was a presentation by Google people about Google AppSail, which is their low-level library, which has all sorts of cool stuff. And it's the presentation was called Live at Head, and the idea is that instead of having releases, what you should do is that you can just live on the head of all of your dependencies. So that's not the exact description, but it's like as a rough estimate. And at 1 hour and 20 minutes into the video, and you can check this out if you don't believe me, there's a question about what about build times? And then Titus Winders holding a presentation says, buy another CPU. Also, he advocates the use of their competitors' products, which is a bold choice. Very good. And a bit later, he says that build times are annoying, but they're also a solved technical problem. It is one of resources. Is it? If you look at this presentation, there's a presentation at Flutter, Flutter release, Strange Loop 2017, and in the YouTube video over at 5 minutes and 6 seconds, there's a person presenting saying, we have spoken to Google developers who have tens of minutes dev cycles waiting for Xcode. And Eric Seidel, also from Google. So even if you have spare data centers to do your builds in, sometimes you just can't use them. Okay, so Eric Seidel saying here that they had tens of minutes of dev cycles. This makes me kind of wonder that one of these two people didn't get the memo. I'm not sure which one it was. Anyway, but if we were to do this, so let's say what we do. Okay, static linking, embedding all the dependencies, do all of that. What would it actually mean? Well, if you want to participate in Linux userland development, you would require having a spare data center because that's how much computing capacity you need to do stuff. And as an example, there's the reproducible builds, which is a great thing, and hopefully they'll get their get the next version of Debian fully reproducible. It was like not done with a data center. There was like just a few people. It's like, hey, we should do this, and with the machines and resources that they had, they were able to do that because you could do each bit in isolation. And this becomes harder or impossible if everything is embedding everything. Then you get the resource things that the carbon footprint of development distro goes by a factor of 1 million. Is this something that's totally fine? Is it acceptable? Any platform that's not x86, PowerPC, or OS390 can only be cross-compiled because the CPUs of that platform are not fast enough to do the entire thing. Even if you had the entire production for 1 year of all the fab machine plants in the world, so these are only cross-compilable. Is this something that's okay? Is it acceptable? Any platform that's not x86 or ARM is not actually supported because most of these new programming languages only support x86 and ARM. And then when you ask them about it, they say, well, I'm sure we can put resources in this in the future when this is an issue. And this is, in plain English, what this means is we don't care and it's not supported. But at least we have the dependency problem solved, right? No. So, since if we continuing with this completely hypothetical things, let's take a hypothetical project that's currently written in C, and people who have been converting it into Dost. It has 15 build dependencies in Debian. If you check for that, and if you take the partially to Dost converted version, it has 65 new source dependencies, which none of which are in any distro. And if you look at the lock file that's in there, the hypothetical lock file that's in there, you'll find that there are some dependencies which are there multiple times with different minor versions. And some are links to random people's GitHub repos with questionable license declarations and stuff like that. And what this means is that the future of Linux userland dependency management is Node.js. This is what it's heading towards. And then you might go to a conference where there are people presenting these sorts of things and advocating these new programming languages, and then they will tell you that, well, we're just going to do this, and the distros will just have to deal with it. Okay, so the obvious follow-up question is can this trend be stopped? And this is a question to which no one has an answer. But do we actually want to do this? After all, getting dependencies easily from the internet with very little fuss is a good thing. That's what we want to have, especially if you have a multi-platform project and you need to build on something that's not Debian or Fedora. You need to have a way to get dependencies. If you are developing, as an example, GNOME developers use JH build to get all of the new dependencies because they're not in the distro, simply because of the reason that they are not being released yet. And this is a thing that you need to have. So in Meson, we have some sort of a solution for this, or a proposal for one, is that the build definition for your project should be identical regardless of where the dependencies come from. So this is kind of what it looks like, which you can use today. So in the middle line, which has the zdip, and they have dependency on zlib, and then it says fallback. And this is the nomenclature that we have, is that you should look up zlib on the system, and if it's available in there, just use that one. And if it's not available, then get it from this sub-project called zlib. And zlib dep is the internal dependency that's defined inside of that dependency. And then you have your executable, which uses zlib, and it just says that it uses the zlib, and it doesn't matter where it comes from, but the build definition is the same, and you can just get it built like that. It can come from the system, it can come from the package config, you can ship pre-built library package, You can ship pre-built libraries as a like a sub-project that you can just put in there and use. It can be built from source transparently during the thing, and whatever mechanism gets invented in the future for delivering dependencies, we just add support for that, and things work behind the scenes. And so and then it gets even trickier, because if you have one language, like if you have an entire project in C and multiple ones, it's very simple. But if you have many different languages in the same project, then things get really, really difficult. The future is always hard to predict, but what will probably happen based on current knowledge of things is that there's going to be different components, like shared libraries or something like that, that's going to be communicating with each other over C API, but they're going to be implemented in various different other languages. So you can have a dependency where you have something in C, then a dependency on a thing that's written in C++, and then you have something in D, and then you have C++ again, and then you have Rust, and so on. But the thing is that if you, C API is the thing that's actually stable, and you can talk with, between different languages. So this seems like a fairly probable reason of how things are going to go. And then, if you have a project that looks like this, it should be buildable using one dependency resolver and one build tool. You can have possibly several different build tools, but like if you have more than one dependency resolver inside one project, don't. It's not going to go down well. As an added bonus, there are some languages which are actively hostile towards using a build tool that's not their own. And this is unfortunate. So some sort of cooperation mechanism needs to be invented here, just so that all of these different languages can work together and all the projects can work together. I don't know, have a really good solution on what that should be, but there really should be some sort of discussion on how this, on the best way of getting this done. In depressing conclusions, first of all, the process of building software has gotten a lot faster. It's gotten a lot more pleasant. And it's just not me saying that because I'm the guy who wrote the thing, but actually other people who are using it, and they've been very happy. On the other hand, there is going to be some sort of dependency disruption on the horizon. We don't really have a good grasp on it. And something's going to give, because the approach that the modern languages are using don't really fit well with the way distros work today. And so something's got to give. What's the thing that's going to happen? We don't know. But hopefully we can work on something that's actually a good thing, a good solution for everyone, rather than just everyone crying in their own corner and complaining that other people stole my toys. That's the end of it. And if there are any questions, Martin will bring you the mic.
Meson sounds very similar to Bazel, apart from one being written in Python and the other in Java. What are the major differences?
Okay, so the major differences are, as you say, that it's written in Java. So if you have a package that you want to include in the bootstrap set of an operating system, you can't really have a Java dependency on it, because it just blows up. We get comments every now and then that having a Python dependency is too big for many people. So if that's the case, Java is just like, it's just a no-go. Another thing is that it's very optimized towards the way that Google does things. So if your use cases are very similar to those, their ones, then okay, it works pretty well. Again, it's optimized for the static linking cases that they have, and they don't like all the things that you need to support, like installing into Unix directories and all that sort of stuff. I haven't looked too deeply at how that works. It should be possible, but I don't know if it's as smooth as what we have. And also, their Windows support was traditionally non-existent, but they have been putting a lot of effort into that. But I don't know what the status of that is.
They now have default targets for Debian packages, RPM, and tarballs, so they can spit them out directly.
Okay, that's cool.
I wanted to ask if you could expand a bit on how the example you made on declarative making it hard to debug wasn't very clear to me, so if you could expand on that.
Okay, so why are declarative things hard to debug? So how many people here have been doing QML? Okay, a few. So QML is the declarative thing in Qt, where you can define your user interface using a declarative approach. And if you use that, when it works, it's absolutely awesome. You just like tell stuff and everything magically works. And then every now and then you get a bug where your window is slightly off and you can't tell what's happening because the positioning is not done by any of the code that you write. It's done somewhere inside a black box. And like, okay, now I have to debug this somehow, and it gets very difficult. But because you can't do printf debugging, because there is no sequence of steps that you could take where you could say, okay, now in this place, this is what things should be, and you can't test for that. So this is a tooling problem. So if you have a really good tooling debugging story for your declarative thing, then it could probably be a lot better. But we don't have the resources to create both a debugging system for this, which is it's not very common to have very good tooling for these sorts of things, and to also write a build system. So we decided to do this thing.
And I have another question. I was wondering if you had looked into Nix, and if so, what your opinion on it was.
And so Nix OS. I haven't looked into it too much, but I know that there are people building Mezen file projects on it, and it works. So that's that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Nix does the thing where it installs packages into their own locations, right? Yeah. Okay. So we support that. So if you want to lay out your output in a different way, we totally support that, and all that should work. From our perspective as build system developers, it's not really that much of a difference. It's just their choice on how they want to lay out their files. As far as the deeper dependency resolution thing go, I haven't looked into it that much. Okay, so I'm told there's 1 minute. Nope, sorry. Okay, thank you.